Om Gyane Timurandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Daksur Mulutam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Ite Tanya Mano Bishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Sayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Sapagantikam Vanshakalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasade Gaur Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. 1 second here. I want to share kind of what's a mystical experience that happened within the last few hours, but greetings from Moscow. Yesterday, I have a place, a very beautiful place called Shanti Shakti. There's white sandstone on the out. It's beautiful. And it's a spa with many things, treatment rooms and yoga studio. And it's in this kind of gated community near the airport, a very large gated community. And and the second floor is room residences for my quarters, which is beautiful. I have my own satsang little hall. In the evening, I give satsang, and I have like a suite of rooms, actually. And then there's doctors, Ayurvedic massage people from Kerala. And then, some people that may come to help. And the top floor is the residences of the family who owns it, who are my disciples. But yesterday, there's a program right in the middle of the city. And probably it's walking distance from Red Square, which is right in the middle of Moscow and the most exclusive neighborhood. And this particular street, they don't even have cars. It's not that big. It's wide, but there's no cars. And the people who are close with me, they stay with me in Govardhan and assist me every Govardhan. And kind of like disciples. And they have this apartment, and it was given to them by the great-grandfather, was the director of the Bolshoi Ballet. And, one of the most famous opera singers in the country ever. So the Tsar gave them this apartment. Really, like real high ceilings and, seven large rooms with all the family, and the person was born there with all the family artifacts. It's like a museum. It really is like a museum. All the family artifacts from so many years ago. I actually stayed over there because we went Tuesday. So I got back late, and my habit is more than 80% of the days I'm up at 1 a.m. in the morning, and or before, to do more writing, chanting, etc. We got back so late last night that I didn't get to bed until after 10:30. And my habit is, when I go to bed, within 5 hours, I'll get up, rested. So I got up, it was 3:30 a.m., and the class here is 4 a.m. So I didn't really have much time to get ready. It's a little mystical, you'll see. I didn't have really much time to get ready. I went to the bathroom and got ready, and I opened up my computer, because as you know, if the email doesn't work, then you know, you can send me an email telling me that the, because I gave a class and it went off. I didn't know when I was in a place. So I always keep the, when I turn the computer on, it opened up. I don't have myself a Facebook way to enter the computer, but Brzezinski Shore set it up. So it goes through a particular Facebook page. And then I looked and there was a picture of Tamal Krishna Maharaj. And his brother, Kalachandriya Karl, at Bear Mountain State Park when Karl was only about 7 or 8 years old. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj was only about 20. Now, the reason why that's mystical is, you know, I sleep very soundly and I don't really remember the dreams. But I had a dream last night and I realized I had a dream. And if I didn't see this photo, I wouldn't have realized that I had a dream. And the dream was, is that I was giving a class in Moscow. And I was using Tamal Krishna Goswami as an example of something. And somehow Giriraj Swami was in the audience. And when I started explaining the story, because he knows him better, he started giving details. And then I gave him the mic, you speak. And then he started to speak about Tamal Krishna Maharaj. Now, what's mystical about that is that it was Tamal Krishna Maharaj's disappearance day. And I never dreamt about him, and I never dreamt about Giriraj Swami and what to speak on that day. So that's kind of mystical. I guess it means that I'll have to figure it out more because it's deep, but that I'm supposed to, that I should glorify him. And that's what Krishna wants me to do. And, you know, I'm waking up to this class. So I guess at least a little bit will do it because he was a very close friend of mine. Somehow or other, we became very, very close. Although when, you know, I first joined and a little while after that, he was one of the zonal acharyas, you know, and it was kind of like in another category, you know. But as you go on in Krishna consciousness, if initially in Krishna consciousness, if someone was 3 years joined before you, he was so much senior. And, you know, Tamal Krishna Maharaj was joined in the 60s, so it was even more. I met the devotees in 70, joined in 74. So he was senior, but, you know, as you go on, you know, when you're young, if you're 5 and your brother is 1, that's a big difference. And then if you're 10 and he's 5, that's less of a difference. And you're 15 and he's 10, that's less of a difference. And when you're 20 and 20, 15, that's less. 25 and 20 and 30 and 25 until it's like 55 and 50, it's not much of a difference. So gradually we became very, very good friends. And yeah, and I just meant, you know, just two qualities from him that I think we could learn a lot. And one was humility, and really what understanding what humility is. Because he was a very controlling person. Everyone knows it. It was his nature. He was very, very particular about the environment and moving things around him to suit his environment. Now, in itself, that doesn't seem like a very spiritual quality. And it was probably something that he struggled with spiritually. It was pretty pronounced. I mean, the examples of the degree that he was concerned with and the power he had to control it. I mean, I'm going to explain that. You know, in fact, in Mayapur, but during the GBC meetings and all these things, I wasn't a GBC. When I came to Mayapur, I would stay in his apartment. And there's only one bathroom in the apartment. But to give you an idea how, you know, his apartment was on the corner of the Conch building, and it's a beautiful view. And the construction of this Pujari building, you know, was going to block his view. And anyway, he was flying out, and when he flew out, he stopped in London, and there was a meeting of the Mayapur, whatever, and, you know, he got it stopped. He was very particular about his environment, and he had so much power to control it. But, of course, he was dedicated to Prabhupada. So even though it was kind of for his own needs, his own desires, how he liked things to be, still, he was fully engaged in Prabhupada's service. And everything kind of became purified in one sense. But now one time I was staying with him, and he was so practically intelligent. It was off the charts how practically intelligent he was. Not as like a scholar, although when he went back to school in his 50s, to, you know, he didn't have a bachelor's, to go back to school because he felt that he should preach in the academy. And he went, when he went back to school, he got the highest grades in the history of the university. The highest grade. Everything was A-plus honors. But he was so meticulous, being, you know, a GBC, a guru, and going to school, that he wouldn't waste any time. So he figured a way to go and leave where his driver would drive in a way where he wouldn't miss any lights, and at a particular time where there's no traffic. One time he missed a light, and he had his assistant go to the Department of Motor Vehicles because the timing was off. Because that's the only way he could. And he got them to refix that light, you know, even though the timing was off. So it seems almost like a fetish to the degree that he was kind of controlling. And sometimes it'd be very difficult to be with him. And people would know that. But his humility was, and this is the real quality of humility, because we'll have different natures. It's not just being meek, although that certainly can be a sign of humility, and it's certainly noteworthy. But the key for humility is the acceptance of authority, and to be happy with it, which means the recognition that there's something above me that determines what my world is and what my world should be, then it's higher than my own desires. And not only the recognition of that, but the innate liking of that. My friend was initiated by a great scholar in Vrindavan, probably the most learned scholar in Vrindavan. And he was in his 90s. And when he would go to a doctor, my friend would go with him. And he was so impressed that he was so surrendered to the doctor. He was so surrendered. It was just a natural samskara that there is truth that is authority beyond my own desires and perceptions of things. So it manifests that way just with a doctor. He's the medical authority. So the tendency is there. So even though on a micro level, by his nature, he was so controlling, which looked like one is not humble, and excessively is trying to impose one's desires and perceptions on the environment, that was incidental to his nature, but his conscious desires and perception was not micromanage, but to be managed, and to live my life by an authority greater than my own. And that was reflected in two ways. One, that he fully surrendered to Prabhupada and liked to do so. In fact, he gave his whole life to Prabhupada. This is beyond his accomplishment, but I remember one time at a disappearance festival of his, where we established his samadhi in Govardhan, his Pushpa samadhi. Madhavish Maharaj, one of the early devotees, gave a glorification and gave a history of practically everything that's significant in the movement. Kamal Krishnamurti was there. He gave so many examples from, you know, spearheading the preaching in Europe when they met the Beatles. I forgot so many examples from getting the land in Mayapur, the deed to the land in Mayapur. Even in his last days, he was managing Prabhupada. Prabhupada put the management of ISKCON practically in his hands. I don't know the history, but it was phenomenal. It skips my mind right now, but everything significant. Kamal Krishnamurti was at the forefront of. So he gave his life to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada really trusted him. But he was completely surrendered to Prabhupada. I mean, the whole story with the Radha Damodar buses, where he was spearheading book distribution, but, you know, his nature, you know, was so expansive, and they were taking all the brahmacharis out of the temple, something caused, and Prabhupada stopped it, and then he became very upset, and almost was a little bit arguing with Prabhupada, and then said, you know, I might as well go to China. And Prabhupada said, yes, you should go to China. Yes, you should go to China. And yes, you should go to China. And then he went to China. And he established Krishna consciousness in China. You know, I had a taste of it when his disciple Radha Charan brought 30 Chinese people, and it was the most, to Vrindavan, it was the most ecstatic group I ever had. But he went. I think he went to China, and then within a year, he had the Chinese Gita translated, and so anyway, he was completely surrendered and happy to follow, you know, Prabhupada's will. And I would have to say, to give him credit, it's like in a sports event like diving or figure skating, your score is not what you accomplish, but multiplied by the degree of difficulty in doing it. You know, if you're diving, you just do a swan dive, you can get all 10s, but your score won't be high. But if you do like a triple backflip twist, then the degree of difficulty would be more. And someone can do a swan dive perfectly. You can do it a little less perfectly or a lot less perfectly. You'll still get a much higher score. So I think, you know, by his nature, having that super practical intelligence that demanded such a control over the environment, which on a micro level wasn't so spiritual, you could say, but that created a degree of difficulty in really kind of surrendering, that because he did so and gave himself the Prabhupada, I think he even gets more credit. I remember one time in his room in Vrindavan, he was crying. He was crying. And he was talking about how he wasn't that pious. And how, you know, before he was a devotee, we shouldn't talk about this too much. He you know, was very good with the women. I don't, you know. And so he felt, you know, wow, you know, and then I'm coming to Krishna consciousness. And he was describing other people. And he mentioned Jayapataka and Indradumna Swami. He thought they were much more pious than him. You know, I'm not that pious by nature. That was also humility. But, you know, a degree of difficulty. And, you know, and that shows you what bhakti is. It's really your dedication. More than renunciation, although he became a celibate, which also, by that passionate nature, you know, probably also was more difficult than just, you know, a simple sattvic kind of person. But so many left, and he stayed. So that was on the one level. There was two levels. So one, he was surrendered to Prabhupada, but even a greater demonstration of his humility is, even though he was so powerful, and he was so powerful, he could have isolated himself, as many very powerful leaders in our movement did, and then fell down. He was very surrendered. To his godbrothers. He was humble. he would consider their will his authority, and he associated with them, which many people couldn't develop in that position, collegial relationships. Many people in those positions of authority, they don't make close friends with other people in positions of authority, and don't put themselves under their authority. You know, Bori Jean Prabhu said that it would be a really good thing, you know, for leaders in ISKCON, even gurus, to just choose three people as their authority. Otherwise, the tendency is so much to supersede the will of God with what you want to do, because there's no one checking it, even very subtly. But he kind of really put himself under the authority of his God brothers and really always consulted with them humbly. And I'll give you a personal example of that. I used to always visit him on the way back from India in Cambridge or Oxford, either on the way back or the way to. We were such good friends. And I would visit him, which sometimes wasn't easy because it was really his world. And sometimes I remember even I get really like upset. You know, this is just too much, you know. It's too much. It's how he sees the world according to his desires. This is too stifling for me. Although at the same time, he was the world's greatest host, for sure. He really took care, and he really, you know, he's a friend. He's really at your back. Actually, I recently found a letter he sent to me when I was going through whatever tussle I was with the authorities that be. The personal letter he wrote to me of support is really, really touching and moving. But he was at a crossroads. He was finishing his PhD. And he was so practical. He studied, he's getting his PhD in religion, and using his whole experience. When he picked the thesis, he was so intelligent. The thesis was on the theology of Prabhupada, because he wasn't going to waste his whole other 30 years in what he learned. So that was his thesis on the theology of Prabhupada. But he was finishing it, and he was asking, he said, now what will I do? Now what will I do? He said, I'm not just going to go to university and teach six people. You know, he's big. So he's figuring what he was going to do. And he started to talk to me. And then he told me, and I consider this a great honor and compliment, because he probably had the greatest practical intelligence known to man. But he started to listen to me, and he said, actually, he said, of all my God brothers, he said, Bori Jean gives the best academic advice. Ratatvaja Swami is the person I feel most comfortable being with. And you give the most practical intelligence, practical advice. And it wasn't just words, because he said, you know, I'm working on my PhD. I'm taking the day off just to talk to you. So we talked, and he was worried about coming back to Mayapur and the GBC meetings after 5 years, you know, almost feeling an exile, you know, for certain reasons. He went into the academy because he didn't feel he can be empowered within ISKCON to the degree of his capabilities, etc. So anyway, time heals all wounds. He's coming back. So the first thing he said, the things I told him, he actually did. I told him You know, he was so immersed in academia, and he hadn't really, you know, given classes on the Shastra. He was just studying all these books. And so the Chinese devotees are coming. What should I teach them? I believe I told them you should do Isha Upanishads in the morning, just to them, no one else. I told them every noon you should go bathing in the Ganga. And in the evening, you should have kirtan in your room. He had quite a big room. Those kirtans in his room were famous. They expanded so rapidly, they moved to the temple. And that eventually became the kirtan mela in Mayapur. And I also told them, you know, you don't know Niranjan Swami, you should meet him. He's a very nice Vaishnava. And he did. Niranjan Swami's coming to his room. And in that short time, and then he passed away, leaving Mayapur. And Niranjan Swami is one of the people that even went to pick up the body. And a great person who surrendered his life to Prabhupada and gave everything to Prabhupada, and that's the essence of spiritual life, really. No matter who you are, what your nature is if you give your life to Krishna through Guru, it's a liberated platform, actually, because the identity changes. All of a sudden, it becomes another center besides yourself. And that center for those in Prabhupada's mission is Prabhupada and those who represent them, him, your Diksha or Siksha gurus. And when you're determined to live your life with that conception expressly, then the mercy of Krishna flows through you. Love flows through you. Perfection flows through you. And this is what Prabhupada so clearly taught, the essence of spiritual life, to surrender to Guru and Krishna. And this is what Tamal Krishna Maharaj exemplified. I could go on and on, honestly, now that I began, but I think that was there. So this lecture is only the result of a dream that I had maybe 2 hours ago. On the day of his disappearance, right before I'm to wake up because of the time difference and in 4 a.m. give this class. So we have a little time now for the Jiva Dharma. Thank you. So, you know, we're in this beautiful story of the Jiva Dharma. And we're following the spiritual life of Rajanath. And he doesn't want to get married. His family is pressuring him. And one of his cousins, who's really an evil man, tries to cause dissension with his guru by misrepresenting him to his guru and misrepresenting his guru to him. It doesn't work, because the bond between the guru and disciple is so much of a higher reality than any rumors. And that can happen to someone, that the politics about them are so variant with who that person is, that even though the politics may seem to be verified as substantial, because it's incongruent with what you experience of the person, you accept what you experience of the person rather than what you hear about them. And, you know, his guru, Babaji, when he sees him, he tells that, from my experience, I really know who's a Vaishnava and who's not. And we don't need to say anything more about this. So then Vrajanath continues his education. And because you're talking about Jiva Tattva, now how does the Jiva become free? And Babaji Maharaj says your answer is in the Dashramula. And this is what he's been teaching him, the Dashramula. And it's the seventh Dasamula, which describes that you become liberated. You're wandering in all kinds of species in the world until you meet a Vaishnava who has this real Hari Bhakti, real love for Krishna. And then Ruchi arises in one's heart by following that person. And by chanting the name of Krishna, you become free from your conditioning. And then, step by step, you become qualified to taste that rasa yourself. And then Vrajanath always wants things, even though he heard it from his guru, substantiated by Shastra. And his guru quotes some verses of that. And then he asks, you know, really to define liberation, and Babaji explains that it's not just to be released from Maya, but it's to be situated in your sarup. It's not just getting rid of the ego, it's getting rid of the false ego and being established in the real ego. And then he asked, what are the symptoms of a liberated person? And, you know, they were explained how he's free from sinful activity and he's transcendental to the body. He's always blissful, and so many other things. Now, I remember Gail asked questions about this. And then he asked him, if can you attain Hari Bhakti by pious activities, such as Ashtanga Yoga and cultivating Brahmagyan or knowledge, Sankhya. And Babaji just quotes Krishna's words, a verse from the 11th canto, Narodiyati Mam Yogo Nishankyam Dharma Evacha. You know, it's not by yoga, sankhya, austerities, nothing. It's by sadhu sangha. That can control me. That can get my mercy. And then he talked about association like a crystal ball. A crystal ball reflects the qualities of that which come in its proximity, and we will reflect the qualities of the sadhu. And even unintentional association with the sadhu. And then there were so many verses that he quoted. And then Vrajanath wanted to know about Sukriti. You know, what is that Sukriti? Is it karma or gyan? He said, actually, there are two types of Sukriti, auspicious activities. One is bhakti, and others, they give really inferior results, even liberation. Pious activities and the things, you know, the naimittika karma, the you know, the things we observe according to the particular time of the year, and the things we do every day, and studying Sankhya. But the only thing is Bhakti Pradasu Kriti, associating with Shuddha Bhaktas and with places and things that bestow Bhakti. And when you do that, you'll come to the platform of Bhakti. And the other thing, this was an interesting point, the other types of Sukriti and Karma and Gyan, when you enjoy them, you use them up. But Bhakti, when you get it, and you start acting that, your Bhakti Sukriti only increases. So they don't accumulate to give any permanent results. So all these activities, such as Sadhu Sangha and observing Ekadasi, Janmasthami, Gaur, they help you to develop saintly qualities. And Tulsi, Mahaprasad, the temple, holy places. And these are things that are Bhakti, Pradasu, Kriti, give rise to Bhakti. Brajanath, can a person obtain Bhakti if he's tormented by material problems and take shelter of Srihari's lotus feet and full knowledge to become relieved of his problems? So what if you can attain this Bhakti? Because this Bhakti is what leads to liberation. If you're tormented by material problems and take shelter of Srihari's lotus feet. Babaji, the jiva harassed by the afflictions of the goddess of illusion may somehow understand through discriminating intelligence that worldly activities are simply troublesome, and that his only solace is Krishna's lotus feet and the feet of his Shuddha Bhaktas. Knowing this, he takes shelter of his feet, and the first step in this process is surrender to the shelter of Shuddha Bhaktas. The principal act is Bhakti Pradasu Kriti, through which he attains the lotus feet of Bhagavan. Whatever renunciation and wisdom he had originally were just a secondary means of attaining Bhakti. Thus, the association of Bhakti is the only way to attain Bhakti. There's no other recourse. So you may have the desire for liberation and take the devotional service, but then you have to take shelter of a devotee. So the other things don't really cause Bhakti. The association of devotees does. Or you may be a very pious person in Varnashram and host sadhus, and one of the sadhus comes as a devotee, and you get his association, and then you'll move forward. In fact, dharmasya yapavargasya nartasya yapyakalpate, that dharma leads to liberation. Dharmasya yapavargasya is the purpose of dharma, but how does it lead to liberation? It leads to liberation because if you're pious, you'll do things that give you a chance to associate with the devotees. It'll give you two things that give you a chance to associate with the devotees. And that's the only way to attain Bhakti. Brajanath, if karma, gyan, renunciation, and wisdom are secondary ways of achieving Bhakti, what is the objection to calling them Bhakti Prada Sukriti? We'll just finish with this one. There is a strong objection. They bind one to inferior temporary results. The performance of karma has no permanent results, but it binds the jiva to the objects of sense gratification. Renunciation and empirical knowledge can only lead the jiva as far as the knowledge of Brahman. And this conception of an impersonal supreme principle prevents him from attaining Bhagavan's lotus feet. Consequently, they cannot be called Bhakti Pradasu Kriti. It is true that sometimes they take one to Bhakti, but that is not the usual course of events. Sadhu Sangha, on the other hand, definitely does not award any secondary benefit, but forcibly brings the jiva towards prema. It is explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Satam pasanga mama virya sambhido bhavanti ritkarna rasayana kata tatoshanarasa sapavargivartmani sadharatir bhakti anukramisyati. The association of Shuddha Bhaktas, the recitation and discussion of my glorious activities and pastimes are pleasing both to the heart and the ears. By cultivating knowledge in this way, one becomes established on the path of liberation and progressively attains Shraddha, then Bhava, and finally Prem Bhakti. Are there any questions?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj. This is Gail.
Hi, Bo, Gail.
Yeah, actually, it wasn't on on the book. It was actually, I had a couple about Tamal Krishna Maharaj.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just wondering, a couple of things. I was wondering how it was that a person who was so controlling, you know, about all the details of his life, was wanted to submit himself to his godbrothers, you know, people who were, you know.
Because that was kind of like incidental. That was kind of incidental on... It's kind of, the example would be given, Prabhupada gave it, of someone who had the habit of stealing, right? But he kind of gave it up, but he still had the tendency, right? So he went on pilgrimage with people. In the morning, no one could find their luggage, you know? And everybody was like, where's my luggage? And then they saw it was just in a different place, right? Everything was moved around. And then they said to him, well, how, you know, what happened? Everybody said, I have to admit it. I used to be a thief, but I gave it up. But the tendency was still there. So it was used in a way that was innocuous. So I would say in one sense that on the macro platform, he just really surrendered to Prabhupada. And the rest was just within his service. So what I was trying to explain is that he actually had that humility. He actually wanted authority. The other was incidental. So when it came to major decisions in his life, and even his, you know, what he was doing, he was very much in touch with the consultation and advice of his godbrothers. I think that, you know, there's two sides of Vaishnava. One is their ordinary dealings and one is their inspired side. So everybody has their particular nature, but what is their inspired side? How much are they actually dedicated and surrendered to Guru? And then they'll serve. They'll give everything and they'll be purified. But he really gave his life to Prabhupada completely. And the minor things of organizing the environment, it's just like his nature. It's just like if a lady comes to Krishna consciousness, right? They may like to dress nicely, but that's just part of their nature. They can, you know, it's not that you can't be a great devotee and like to dress nicely. And I just remember this one lady, Mercedes, who I met in India, who was from a kind of a more higher class Argentinian family, and she lived in New York with her own business, and she became interested in Krishna consciousness, and she signed over her whole will to Krishna consciousness. She gave everything to Krishna consciousness. She you know, I was there when she just changed her whole will and signed it over to give to Krishna consciousness. But she was aristocratic, and she liked to dress very nicely, and she liked a nice home. So you can say, well, how can that person be, you know? Well, that was just incidental within their needs. But the macro conception was everything was for Krishna. So I would say that with him. And I gave the conception of the degree of difficulty. He would struggle with that. But... He would perform for Krishna.
So incidental means that the higher
his
thing
nature.
Was
incidental means his nature. his second nature. They call it your second nature. You know, it's not your objective, it's not your goal, it's your second nature. You know, is how you do things. And in bhakti, you don't really focus on that so much. We're not dhyanis, we focus on giving our lives to Krishna. And from that, everything else becomes purified, and you are purified, and you are pure by that. You dedicate yourself to God. Just like my second nature may be to tell jokes, right? You know, and to tell stories, and you know, and then it almost like, you know, I go into a Brooklyn Baba, you know what I'm saying? And I'm not concerned with that, you know. I use it in Krishna's service. I don't think twice about it, and I don't think I can do anything about it anyway. But I hope I'm not judged on that fact, you know. You know what I'm saying? My Rod Dangerfield jokes. I use it in Krishna's service. You know, I tell them to your husband. You got it now, Gail?
Yeah, it's I'm getting it. It's not as, I don't have it as much as I'd like to, but I think I will.
Okay.
And that person who he liked to be with, who was that person?
The Tattvajaswami.
Who?
Ritattvajaswami. He's a very, very humble person. He's a very, very humble person. And, you know, he's very, very loved. And he's more or less a simple type person. And when Tamal Krishnamurti got sick, he had cancer and then an operation, and they left something in from the operation. He had it again. And it was such a difficulty with him because of that nature of, you know, the environment having to be a particular way. And it was just, he couldn't, you know, so many things were going. He somehow stopped there and became his personal nurse. No one else could deal with him when he was sick practically. And he just was with him. And took him to the bathroom and put him on his back and just took care of him in so many amazing ways. And he just felt so at ease with him.
He had to be a very special person.
Oh, he is. He is. He is. He's a very, very special person. He, you know, Virabhadraram of the Bhakti Center?
Yeah, yeah.
Shore of the Mayapuris, all of them, when they were young, he used to take a bus around the country with all these young kids to give them, you know, fun in Krishna consciousness and you know, going to all the festivals. And every year, he would take a bus with all these kids. And to this day, they love him more than their own life because he took care of them so nicely.
And he stays clear now.
But he's also very sick. He has, I think, an adrenaline problem or something like that. So his body is very, very, very fragile. So he doesn't travel as much as he likes. Because he has to be very specific in taking care of his health. But, you know, he gets around. I know he came up for Virabhadraram's wedding. He stayed, if you see the video of it, there's a short clip of me and him speaking. And he stayed in my house. And, you know, he couldn't, you know, he had to be very, very, he's fragile. He has to take care of himself. Very special diet. And he just takes care of his health and he chants a lot. He just chants a lot. And he has a real taste for the holy name. And he does what he can do in terms of counseling and guiding people. And you know, mostly he stays in a place in Murphy's, Tennessee. He has someone gave him a house. He stays there. And he stays with Brahmatirtha in Gainesville and in Dallas.
He stays here in the States.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he said that he liked to take academic advice from voyage on people. What does that mean?
He was writing his PhD thesis. So questions would be come up on what direction to move, what to write, what to, you know, just the general things of his career in the academy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Gail?
Thank you, Maharaj. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. See you soon.
Yeah.
I'll be back in the States shortly. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna, Guru Maharaj. This is Brajaraja.
We'll also see you in the States very shortly. I'll have to come over to your house, too, one time, like I always do. Okay, great. Anybody else say hello? Okay, good. I always get the numbers, this class. Who's that?
Shaitanya Priya.
Wow, these are like the stalwarts. But there's quite a few people that are listening to the class now. I get the list. Okay, thank you. Anybody else?
Well, Brajaraja, if she's still on, I hear you're doing a program at Gopa's when you come back.
Yeah.
I'm not on Facebook. Braja, if you're still on, what's the date and time of that?
It's the 15th.
The what?
It's the 15th.
The what? The 15th.
It's next Tuesday.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay, Hare Krishna.